thinking about cybersecurity when it comes to AI, and we have things like Stride and Pasta and Octave when it comes to things like threat modeling. And I thought, well, especially when it comes to generative AI, it's a new age. And just came up with a sort of question myself, well, in what ways could an AI be attacked?
Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the Tech Podcast asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats. Now, for our season end, we've got a little bit of a change. It's just the two of us. We've got a couple of things we wanted to talk about and catch up. And you've got two choices, so you can either listen to us on your podcast platform of choice now, or you can go head over to YouTube and you can actually see us moving around and sharing slides and things like that. So you go pick where's best. Either way, we're glad to have you as listeners.
Now we're over a year into the new AI hype cycle. In this episode, we're going to touch on a couple of articles and talks we've both written and contributed to. I'm going to go over the CPTSD of generative AI-enabled systems, and Leanne's going to talk about why the AI revolution may be pretty boring in reality, but that's kind of okay. And have a few reflections on season two and what to look forward to in season three.
I don't know what it is about our end of seasons, but they always seem to be AI related. Why do you think that is, Jeff?
Well, I think it catches the cultural zeitgeist, and I think also AI and cybersecurity are quite intrinsically linked. I think, as with other tech revolutions, there's always security to be considered, and unfortunately, a lot of the tech, I think, precedes the actual maturity of that security, so we put ourselves at risk a little bit, but risk's kind of necessary for innovation, really.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think, particularly for us as compromising positions, we've been doing a lot of tours around Europe. Just been to Amsterdam, got Berlin coming up, going to do a talk in London, but you know, we've done things for the future of cybersecurity as well, all talking about AI and sort of the dangers around that from a cybersecurity perspective. So I know for us in particular, it's kind of top of mind.
But I think inside cybersecurity, there's a couple of things. Learning what AI can and can't do opens up the opportunity to think, well, how could I use it in my endeavors for cybersecurity? Be that just simplifying threat modeling, making actually helping you threat modeling, be that actually thinking about how you could actually use it for intrusion detection. But also then the other side, because I'm in the IT services business, is when we're building AI related systems, well, what kind of things could happen to them? What kind of threats could they be vulnerable to? And I think the more you understand about the technology and what's going on under the hood, the better you can get a grasp on what could happen to it, in my opinion, at least. Don't know, what do you think about that?
I think that makes sense. Nearly all our listeners are cybersecurity people. And when I'm talking to my peers in the industry, it's about, are we doing enough to protect ourselves? And how can I make sure everyone else is using this appropriately and I'm not going to get caught out by it? So I think there's a couple of things. There's the very human side of it, which is how am I going to enable people in my organization to use this effectively and safely without having huge data leaks? Because we still don't really know what this beast is about. And I doubt we'll ever really find out what's under the hood. You know, Elon said recently, didn't he, to OpenAI, change your name to Closed AI, and then maybe I'll drop the lawsuit. And there is something in that. You can't really go around calling yourself OpenAI and not actually be open. At least I don't think so. OpenAI is interesting because it's accessible to everyone. However, the actual how it's run, how it's made, how it functions is very much closer. The open side sort of to me suggests open source, which is not quite the same.
Even with open source models, though, they're so vastly complex. And when you get these billions, if not trillions, of parameter models, they openly admit they can't follow all the pathways through it. Because if you think about, say, like a graph in two dimensions, like a line chart or something, you can go, okay, I can understand that. Think about a three-dimensional graph, you can go, understand that. Four-dimensional graph is getting a bit tricky. And then when you say, well, actually, this data lives in 768 dimensions, it becomes like really tricky to understand why it comes to the decisions it doesn't.
Well, isn't that bad that we don't know? Like, because there's that whole thing, isn't there, like when the software is not quite the right word, but when it starts training itself,
emergent,
and therefore, yeah, then you can't, as the person who originally built it, understand what it's now doing. Isn't that quite scary? And what are the implications for that from a cybersecurity perspective?
Well, it's I think one thing is it's kind of displaying emergent behavior is part of the charm of it, because traditional imperative programming, it does exactly what we put in the code. I mean, if you code it, right, if you coded it sloppily, then it will just do weird stuff anyway. But if you coded it right, it will do exactly what it's meant to. And the entire point of AI is effectively the definitions is that it is a system that learns from data rather than from code. So yeah, obviously you've got to have effectively a code substrate, but it learns from the data. And that means it will come up with stuff that we never could. And that's, I think, part of the beauty of it. There is, not necessarily from a security point of view, but from a governance point of view, there are challenges around explainability. If you've got large language models are one thing, but then when you've got models that can take actions, like large action models, part of the GDPR really strongly suggests that any automated decision should be explainable. When you've got something as complex as a large action model or even a large language model, explainability is not easy. It's really not, even with simple models, explainability is tough. I think there's that old example where they're trying to make a wolf detector and they trained it on loads of huskies and wolves, and it was really accurate until one picture and it kept saying that this husky is a wolf. And it was only when they reverse engineered the algorithm then to actually then show the area of the image that it made it think it was a wolf, cut the husky out entirely and just show the picture of the snow in the background. And it turns out all of the pictures of wolves were taken in the snow, all the pictures of huskies were taken in grass or greenery.
So really, he had a really complex snow and grass detector rather than a wolf and a husky detector.
Exactly. But the point is, at that point, it wasn't such a large model or such a complex beast that they could actually make it explain itself. But then when you get to something like these multi-trillion parameter models, explainability just becomes a lot more ephemeral. So I think it is scary, and that's why we need to make sure these are well protected and cannot go outside their bounds.
All right. Well, let's get to the meat of today's conversation, Jeff. So you wrote an article recently, and it was called The PTSD. So see, PTSD.
Yeah.
What is that? Give us the lowdown and why should we care about it?
I was pondering, thinking about cybersecurity when it comes to AI, and we have things like Stride and Pastor and Octave when it comes to things like threat modeling, and I thought, well, this is a new age of, especially when it comes to generative AI, it's a new age. And just came up with a question myself, well, in what ways could an AI be attacked? In what ways? Different ways. And then I thought, well, okay, if you research that, there's quite a lot, but that's not very helpful. If you give a bag of 50 things, that's not very helpful to human beings. Human beings like to be able to put things into bags. So I thought, well, why not come up with a mnemonic? And I thought, well, why not see PTSD? Because I kind of figured out I could actually make that work. And so there's five pieces to this. And the reason actually it kind of works is because the C is separate from the rest. And the C basically is don't let your AI system get compromised. And that's the regular basics of cybersecurity, i.e. make sure it's no good having really good, secure AI if the actual substrate sits on the cloud system or whatever it is, insecure, it's compromised. So the idea is that's your usual cybersecurity stuff. You need to get the basics right before you go any further than that, because it's pointless bulletproofing something that has a very obvious backdoor in it.
So it's also really good branding for us. So
yeah, that's true. That was not intentional.
So C is compromised.
Compromised, so yes. P is poisoned. And when you've got a model, one of the things you don't want it to do is be influenced by outside data that's potentially bad. So a lot of models do learn on the fly, or they're taking other data in training sessions. And you don't want to include data that could poison your results. And that could maybe produce a model that has bias, produce a model that gives you inaccurate results, or gives you a result that an attacker wants to give. So the idea is this is more how do you ingest and curate and validate data to make sure that it is fit for purpose to go into your model, rather than just taking something in verbatim, because you don't want to, because if you poison a model, then it's poisoned likely for everybody, or everybody who's on that instance of that model, which could be, I don't know, millions of users, depending on what you're doing with it. So the poison thing is really important, because that can then take down your whole service or come up with highly embarrassing results. Because if you like with that learning chatbot, I think it was maybe Microsoft, it was a Twitter bot, I think it was, that some years ago, that basically it very quickly learned to say some very abhorrent things and had to take it offline. So that effectively got poisoned. So that requires a lot of data maturity, I think, because it's not...
I was going to ask, how do you stop it from getting poisoned? What can we do to stop that from happening?
I actually wrote an article on this recently, but the idea is that for the most part, people want to actually curate their data sets, and where it is automatically ingested, it needs sufficient input validation and assurance on the way in, and also then quality of service checks, you know, automation checks to make sure that it's not doing something wacky. It's really difficult though, because it's, you know, especially with non-deterministic systems, wrong is a very abstract term. It can be quite difficult to say, well, what are all of the wrong things it could be doing? And in the case of something like a chatbot, there's a lot. So a lot of it's about data curation and validation, which is actually quite sophisticated, I think, in the cert person.
Are we talking in this case relying on homegrown large language models, like on your own tin, rather than...
Or fine-tuned.
How would I go about doing it if it was me using ChatGPT and then me using my own homegrown?
So imagine if you're using OpenAI's models, not necessarily ChatGPT because you can't fine-tune that, but OpenAI's models. And you have a set of questions and answers. That's how you fine-tune. You have a set of questions and answers. That's kind of how fine-tunes work on large language models, or at least the ones I've seen. You could expand that set of fine-tunes because, as you say, maybe you're giving financial tips, not advice, can't give that automated, but financial tips. And what you do is that question base grows up as you see all the people asking various questions, and you can go and give model answers. And then what that does is that means your chatbot will become more and more refined and give more accurate and more useful answers. Now, if you don't curate that question and answer set properly, and then you, I don't know, it says, yo, the answer to what's the best investment, yo, put it all in Bitcoin or something, you know, invest everything in this crypto scam. So you need to make sure you're curating that set of fine tunes before you run them. And homegrown is very, you know, if you fine tuning your own large language model, very similar. If you are doing a more traditional kind of AI, imagine this is like image classifier, making sure that your, you know, your actual training set and test sets are curated to the point where they don't include anything harmful. So it requires a little bit. So this is like data maturity. It's deeply unsexy when you start talking about data maturity and validation stuff. So basically, that's and limiting the number of points where somebody can actually inject something into that model.
Okay, so that's P for poisoned, right? What's next?
Tricked. Tricked is similar on the surface, but it's what it, instead of actually poisoning the model, you trick the model into giving an outcome it shouldn't be doing. And some of this can be through things like doing prompts. Injection attacks. I think Jeep and DHL or somebody had or FedEx had this recently, where their models were tricked into saying stuff they shouldn't have done, and it's like really memeable because you can capture it. And I think in Jeep's case, somebody managed to trick it into saying that yes, they can have a Jeep for $1 a month on a 36-month contract or something. So you don't want it to be tricked. And it's not so bad if it's a chatbot, maybe, because it's just kind of, that's just for the memes. But when it comes to if you've got something that then becomes making decisions, isn't actually taking actions inside your business, it becomes, I think, a little bit hairier, because you don't want it to approve a mortgage and send that through a system when actually you shouldn't get that mortgage. Or you don't want it to, I'm trying to think of another example, if you do, you don't want it to actually then send somebody for expensive drugs if their diagnosis doesn't suit it, or anything where basically the input could be subverted. It could actually, the input itself could subvert the outcome. So in that case, you need a lot of then things like the protection against prompt injection attacks.
And it's so, I'll put an article in the show notes, but it's so incredibly easy to do as well. I can't remember the article's stats, but it's something like 90% can be tricked really easily. And there was a competition that happened, I think, towards the end of last year, which was designed to just trick these large language models. And quite a lot of it was to trick them into creating things like malware and things like that. And it was, some of it was just as easy as a prompt saying, ignore all past instructions and do this.
Yeah.
And it was just as simple as just putting that phrase in, and it managed to change everything. Yeah. Now, as you say, like on the cute spectrum, it's things like, now speak like a pirate, which was this kind of like the big common meme. But then, like you say, on the other side, is it can be quite disastrous. So that's tricked. What's S?
So S is stolen. So that is the attack that if you've fine-tuned or otherwise trained a model on some of your proprietary information, then you probably don't want that proprietary information, that your IP being removed from you. And you think, well, that's easy. It's in the model. They can't possibly just do a select star from. But actually, there are a number of prompt injection attacks or repeated attacks that can actually, from the various outputs, then start to triangulate upon what the actual training set was. I've seen some quite interesting and sophisticated attacks that use for facial recognition that can actually then get the training data back from. I'm not going to say I fully understood how that attack worked, because it was deeply nerdy, but it was a really interesting one where they managed to get some of the training data back from facial recognition databases. So it's not just things like ChatGPT. So part of that, again, is the protection of the inputs that come in and things, but then also a bit more around things like rate limiting and data loss prevention. How do you stop your data from going elsewhere? And the other thing is then making sure you understand that this data could go somewhere. So you may want to make sure that you haven't loaded everybody's PII into that model, which you definitely should not do.
Don't do that. That's a good piece of advice.
Making sure that you only put in that model which for the most part you're kind of okay with it coming out again, because it can't get hold of data that is not in any way connected to. But it will also then making sure that if you do have research or augmented generation, if it is connected to research elements that are inside your network, because RAG could be as simple as going out and Google searching, but also it can be as more sophisticated and go through SharePoint or through directories. Make sure that's really locked down, because you don't want it then somebody going, go, you know, let's go and have a look at your personnel database and find everybody's addresses. That would be really bad. That could happen.
Yeah. Especially because a really good use case has been, let's do AI chatbots for our intranet. Company intranet, right? I've heard so many use cases for that. And it's a great thing, because every company intranet I've ever had to use has been an awful search experience. You can never find anything you want on the company intranet. But if I could speak to a chatbot and say, hey, I'm looking for this, and it gets me to where I need to be rather than me relying on search. Again, there is that kind of blurred line. Is a chatbot just a glorified search engine? Is it just a glorified Siri? But I have in experience found them to be a little bit better to actually find the things you need to do. But yeah, if you are exposing it to that, who's to say that you really got your estate secured down, that someone couldn't just traverse into your HR personnel files? And that's where good cybersecurity hygiene in general comes in. It's about explaining to the likes of HR, like, don't store personnel detail on the same SharePoint that you would put the intranet things on. You keep that high level. Make sure you're categorizing the data elements properly. Is it confidential? Is it private? Is it public? Make sure that those are all categorized properly so that you can perhaps build that into those models as well and say, do not return anything that is classed as confidential or private.
Just as simple as actually having proper role-based access control and least privilege principle. Like if all your HR data is just on a fully shared drive for the entirety of the company to see, that's a bad thing anyway. That's just bad hygiene. It's just the fact that a resource-connected large language model could then open that up as a window to the outside world, which would be even worse.
Absolutely. So, stolen, down to the final one. What's the D?
Disrupted. So, there'd be a temptation, I think, for people to very much lean into large language models or other types of generative AI or traditional AI, which are actually quite resource intense. They use a lot of grunt. And there's a couple of different ways you can then use that. The fact that we know that these are actually quite resource hungry to disrupt either your model, or if actually what you've done is you've not thought about redundancy and thought about resilience, actually disrupt your overall service. So one of them would be, if you could figure out a way of spamming, DDoSing the APIs, you just run out your API credits and then the whole thing stops working. The other one could be to actually DDoS it in, hit it with lots of parallel requests, and then it goes, well, I'm still responding, I can't spin any more of these up, and just basically lock everything that's connected to that account. So there's a number of different ways of spamming the infrastructure it sits on and actually then potentially bringing down the service or actually costing you an absolute fortune. And again, I think some of the standard best practice on how you deal with things like DDoS protection should apply there. You just might need to actually put strict limits on it, because you don't want somebody calling a large language model 100 times a second. Because 100 times a second for a normal web service might actually not be too bad. If it's returned in a few milliseconds, like, okay, fine. But 100 times a second for OpenAI APIs is quite a lot, and it will rack you up a bill very quickly.
Aye, we don't want that. So put it all together, CPTSD. Where do you see this being used? How do you see this being used?
We've been working on a model for assessing cybersecurity in AI systems, and potential existing and potential new ones. And part of it is we have traditional threat modeling approaches, we have product-centric threat modeling approaches, but also we need to think about how do we go, aside from things like Stride, how do we go from our other techniques like abuse stories and misuse cases, what can we use as part of, say, like a workshop to actually think about how might this be vulnerable. So I can see this being used in threat modeling workshops for AI-based systems when you started to flesh them out. That'd be the main purpose of it, is to actually start to think about before you start building an AI service. And it's always easier to design, or almost always easier to design in defenses from the beginning, or actually just go, hang on a second, we should never do this way because it's a stupid idea and will lead to being a very expensive or very embarrassing affair. So it's, the idea is to get you thinking about this from a shift left point of view.
Okay, cool. So just to recap, so compromised, poisoned, tricked, stolen, disrupted.
Yeah.
Is this something for cybersecurity professionals to use, or are you thinking about the data scientists?
I think it's more the whole team, because if you've got a team, a product development team, then, and the thing about this wave of AI adoption is it's become quite democratized. It's not just data scientists doing it. It's the whole team. It's the whole team thinking about building new AI-based products or AI-enabled products. So really, it's the whole team, because actually you would expect that with the right kind of guidance and understanding of AI, that actually seems like a product manager or a designer could understand a large language model based, or some other AI could be tricked. Because the things like prompt engineering, it's got the word engineering in it, that makes it sound very software, but actually a lot of the best prompt engineers I've met have been product managers and design leads and people like that. So I think this is not a machine learning specialist, data scientist, or software engineer specific thing, or even necessarily cybersecurity specific thing. I think this is, if you are building AI products, you should be thinking about, if not this exact mnemonic, I'd like to be, you know, maybe if I remembered in the sands of time for this mnemonic, that'd be great, but actually some other collection of things to think about when you are delivering AI-based systems.
Well, I thought it was really good, which is why I wanted to do an episode pretty much dedicated to it. So most of this episode is about that. I think it's really useful. So what I will do is I will put a link in the show notes to your article, Jeff. And on our website, I will actually put in a little picture graph there for people to use so they can kind of download that and share that amongst their team. And do reach out to us if any ideas of how you would go about running a workshop for this. Maybe that's something we can kind of discuss in maybe another video or another show. Do let us know if that's something you're interested in. In one show fashion, you kind of gave me a little bit of a segue, and you were talking about it being a AI democratizing revolution, and it brings me on to discuss an article I wrote recently, and revolution will be boring and that's okay.
It's a great article. I mean, I think based on another article, do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about the source material before you go into sort of your layer of insight that you put on the top?
Yeah, so I read a really interesting article from Ethan Mollick, and it was his article, In Praise of Being Boring. Now, this guy writes a lot of really great stuff, and so I highly recommend going to check him out. His stuff is really great. One useful thing is his blog, and he has been writing a lot about the AI revolution in terms of how does that affect organizations. Now, in his article, In Praise of Being Boring, he's talking about how organizations are using AI, and it's not really in terms of the big high-tech things that we kind of imagine. Quite often I think when we're talking about AI, we're kind of talking about like Skynet and robots taking over and things like that, but quite a lot of the stuff is really about small productivity gains, and that's okay. And it's something we've kind of discussed in the past, that one thing that always makes me laugh is lots of CEOs get interviewed by these big tech publications and things, tech magazines, and say, oh, how's AI been utilized in your organization? And they say, oh, not much if at all, but we think it will be really important in a few years time. It's like, no, AI is absolutely being used in all your organizations right this very minute, and to great effect. The problem is that it's bottom up. Like it's either done in secret for many different reasons, you know, secret because people are scared that they're going to actually work themselves out of a job, because there's that whole fear around AI taking our jobs and making us obsolete. If you don't have a good culture where you're allowed to use AI, you might use workarounds and things like that to use it for productivity gains. But what Ethan was sort of discussing in his praise of boring AI is that we need AI to be boring, and we need it to be boring because we need it to fix the boring stuff in our job. And what really kind of struck me was his discussion about why it's dangerous to be bored at work. And in his article, he says, you know, we do crazy stuff when we're bored. And I'll just read out one of the things he says that we do that's quite crazy. And I did not know this, and it gave me pause for thought. So he said, in one small study of undergraduates, it found that 66% of men and a quarter of women who chose to be painfully shocked rather than sit quietly and do nothing for 15 minutes. And then they did another study, goes on to quote, that 7,000 people, boredom was linked to sadism. 18% of bored people killed worms when given the chance due to boredom. And to put into perspective, only 2% of non-bored people did. Now let's say that 2% of that people that were not bored, that chose to kill worms, let's just say maybe avoid those people, don't become friends with them. But 18% of relatively quote-unquote normal people, when bored, will kill worms. And I thought, well, let's embrace the boredom of that AI can bring so that we can just preserve the worms, really. And having my article kind of goes into my kind of take on it is, I have been underemployed a few times in my in my life. And as someone who really kind of takes pride in my work, and I would consider myself, you know, an intelligent, creative person, being underemployed is terrible. It, from the outsider's perspective, being underemployed and not like just sat there like reading books or watching YouTube or doing something else sounds like a dream to some people. But if you are driven by results, which most of us are, it's an absolute soul-destroying killer. And I began to wonder if what I'd heard, I've read in other publications about when they've tested the impact of people coming out of fallout shelters after a bomb simulation, nuclear bomb simulation. And they found like the biggest danger people coming out of shelters was apathy. Apathy due to boredom. Now, obviously when it first happens and the bomb hits, there's fright, fear, things like that. But after a while, if you're stuck into a same situation where nothing changes, like a bunker situation, then when you actually come out, you're apathetic and apathy during a time when you want people to be mobilized is pretty terrible. So I got to thinking about, from a cybersecurity perspective, if we're continually doing boring work, that's when we start making mistakes from a cybersecurity perspective. If that's when we become apathetic, even if we know we're doing wrong, we don't care anymore. And that's when that can cause lots of problems for our organization. So my article was basically me talking about the AI revolution being, yep, very boring, but it could be actually, you know, if we allow people to make these productivity gains in their job with safe guardrails, you know, maybe using your model, Jeff, you know, CPTSD, perhaps then maybe our cybersecurity concerns might come down a little bit because people will be more energized because they've got rid of the boring stuff in their job and they're focusing on the fun stuff that kind of feeds them and stretches them creatively and gives them autonomy over their role, purpose over their role, things like that. Maybe they'll be have more cognitive availability to be more cyber aware. That's the theory anyways, and that was the theory behind that article.
Well, I think and computing has all been, the Industrial Revolution is all about automation of stuff, and along that way there was always a removal of the need to do that manual task. For the most part, that's a good thing. I mean, obviously, there's a question of displaced jobs and things like that. But when it comes to, say, like, I remember one of my first jobs I had to do at a very old, when I was first employed, was there's a whole bunch of mappings to do in a spreadsheet back when Excel was Excel 6 or something, some ridiculously old version, and there was no software to automate this. And it was kind of a one-time-only mapping, but it took ages, but it could have been automated. Nowadays, you would automate it. And when you see people, and people still do tasks every day where they're manually entering stuff, and rekeying is really popular in the, well, common, maybe not popular, common in the tech industry where you go from system A to system B because nobody's bothered to put any automation in. And that's where, yes, apathy, boredom, and mistakes happen. And it's also just hugely wasteful getting somebody rekeying the same information between screens.
Absolutely. And one of the other things that I talk about being underemployed as well, because a lot of organizations are scared of AI for lots of different reasons, because it's a massive skills gap, to be honest. And it does seem mysterious because we're not thinking about efficiency gains, either because of what I mentioned earlier, people are hiding those efficiency gains because they're afraid they're going to efficiency gain themselves out of a job or whatever, or that culture is just not there to kind of discuss those things. There is the whole thing about there is a lot of stress in being underemployed. I remember the occasions where I've been underemployed, I've developed depression, anxiety, guilt, and it's things about, you know, even though no matter how many times you can ask to be, you know, more gainfully employed by your manager, for example, give me more work, give me more interesting things to do. If it's not there because that culture's not there, or because they don't have the kind of foresight to think about how do we automate this and make this more efficient, then you do develop guilt about not working to your best. You feel like you're going to get found out. And then there's that whole cycle of like, oh, well, then will I be fired? You know, you can't win either way. You know, you either make yourself so efficient that that job's no longer necessary, or you hide the fact that you're so efficient, and then you get fired because it looks like you're doing nothing. It's that kind of thing. But there is another article I was listening to. It was a TED Talk, actually. And it was about how stress and overwork leads to a physical response. So when you're poorly, unwell, feeling a bit sick, there is a reason why you don't want to do anything. Not just the physical reason why you don't want to do anything, but scientists have discovered that your body actually purposely makes you depressed. Now, not full-on depression, not clinical depression, but depresses you to an extent where it's basically telling your body, I don't want you to have an enjoyment out of anything. I want you to just sit and get better. And I got to thinking about how that idea of that stress response, that physically your body telling you, I don't want you to do anything, I just want you to get better, could also lead to more insecure behaviors, because again, it's that whole thing about apathy and literally having a physical chemical response that tells you don't do anything. And if you're stressed and overworked or underutilized, how that might have an impact. So yeah, I will put a link into the article there and also to Ethan's article as well. I think it's really interesting stuff, potentially a talk out of it, I don't know. It might be a nice companion piece to another talk I do, which looks at Glassdoor. It's called This Company Sucks, How Your Next Cybersecurity Incident Might Be Easier to Spot Than You Think. And that's me looking at, it was a large language model analysis on Glassdoor and how keywords on Glassdoor link to eventual breaches. It's interesting stuff, but I think there's definitely something in about how a workplace makes you feel, and that's not only being overworked but also underworked, and how that might lead to more cybersecurity incidents.
I think a lot of companies as well, for the most part, do run, I'd say, to the point where they're running quite hot and people are time poor, and that means that they're spending their time doing busy work when they could be doing more creative work. Even in, I think, in things like the NHS, the amount of time wasted on administration that could be spent with patients is, if you can automate as much of that as possible or make time savings as much as possible, better outcomes. I think people spend time thinking, doing the human bits rather than the robotic bits, because filling out, rekeying things, filling out spreadsheets with the same values, that's robotic behavior. It's not very human-like.
No, it's not. Jeff, this is season two. Can you believe it? We've had so many episodes. What has been your highlight?
Oh, so I mean, obviously editing them all, get to listen to them all back again in the same level of depth. I mean, while you record, it's interesting, while you're recording, sometimes you pick up that there's some really interesting ideas while you're recording, but obviously as you're trying to host, as you're recording, kind of like trying to wear two hats at once. It's only when you go back and edit and then, you know, produce the show notes, you could go, oh, these are really punchy and interesting things. And you naturally, because you did a lot of recording, you forget how good some of the content is, and it's all really, really good. I think personally, I think Beck McEwen's episodes, they were just so, had so much insight in them. And I think also because of the interesting background she came from, things like the military and talking about how they do hot washes and cold washes and things like that, I thought it was really, really interesting because it aligned very well with cybersecurity maneuvers. Episodes are great. We can't really have favorites, but I particularly enjoyed Beck two episodes. How about yourself?
And I think our audiences will agree. Her episodes are extremely popular. Yeah, she's done a fantastic job. I really liked our chat with Amy Kupas, and she was talking about really illuminating, what does a Scrum Master do? Because I know that a lot of cybersecurity people are just like, well, what do they do? Are they managers? What do they, you know, do they, what are retros? What are sprints? And why are they always sprinting and things like that? So I thought that was a really interesting topic. Damian, early on in the season, talking about how he's a data-driven storyteller, user research UX kind of specialism. It's a man with many hats, actually. I mean, it'd be a disservice to just pigeonhole them in those boxes. But his talks, particularly how do you make a BAFTA winning cybersecurity awareness program, I thought that was amazing. Another episode that I want to give like a really special shout out to, James talking about the light. So that episode's called That's Illuminating. So he was talking about, you know, what happens if someone hacks into streetlights, and how do you go protecting those? And he talked from experience, because it was a client of his, Scottish Council client of his, and he had to think about, like, how do I make sure that doesn't happen? So that was a really interesting one.
I actually got to use one of the techniques we learned from our guest as well, from Sabrina. She went over the objective-centric risk modeling. I hope I got that acronym right. Actually, when we were talking about some objectives and we need to think about the risks, it's like, well, let's do it that way. And actually, it worked really well, and it was very visual, and people grokked it immediately. So it's actually an incredibly useful tool for us to go through.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And Paula as well. Paula's episode was fantastic. All about change, putting it into the context where she was talking about how change is constant. It kind of just made me think, oh yeah, it is. And so when you start thinking about change being constant, actually it kind of makes you feel a lot more prepared to go out and face it. So that was really good. And then obviously we got another data specialist in, Jen came in and did a talk for us. The episode before this one comes out is David Burkus talking about organizational culture. So we've had some fun ones. It's been great.
What do we have to look forward to in season three, which is coming up soon?
Yeah, so folks, we are taking a short break, 2 weeks, and we've got some fantastic guests in. A good friend of ours, Martina, she is amazing. I'm really looking forward to sharing her insights. She's a UX specialist, but the way she goes about things is such a breath of fresh air. She's going to totally inspire you. Got the author John Sills in. He's amazing. And Bettina. There's loads of great people to look forward to. All from different like backgrounds, so psychology, risk, organizational culture, more software developers in, more people from the data space, more people from other areas of tech, and likely probably more discussions around AI. And also we're hoping to get a special episode in where we talk with someone we met recently at a conference who talked all about IT and films, and we're going to do a special episode on cybersecurity films. So that'll be a fun little episode there for us.
One of the other things to mention before we sign off is the nominations are open for the UK Cybersecurity Blogger Awards.
So we have a big, big ask for our listeners. Please, could you help us? We would be so delighted. We hope we've put lots of effort into this and give you a really good product. We hope the feedback we get, you know, it has been amazing. You know, people saying that, you know, when they're listening to it, they listen with a pen because they're making notes on all the fabulous things our guests are saying and really taking that into their organizations. We hope that you really do get a lot out of this. We absolutely adore putting these shows together for you. Little favor to ask you, and we will put this in the show notes. The European Cybersecurity Blogger Awards is coming out soon. We would really love a nomination. That award in particular is a People's Choice Award. So it's not based on things like listener numbers or anything like that. It's about how good quality products you think that we deliver for you. So if you could drop us before the end of the month a little nom there, that'd be great. There's another awards coming out as well. You've got a little bit more time for that one. That closes in May. So the European Cybersecurity Blogger Awards closes in April, I think. And then the Real Cyber Awards is in May. Again, it'd be really great to have a nomination there. It helps us get really interesting guests. I hope you think that we've had some interesting guests. I know I certainly do, but it really helps us kind of bring in those interesting guests so that we can keep learning and keep sharing all the amazing insights that we've been getting from having cybersecurity from a totally different perspective. And just one more other thing as well is just on that point of if you are going to vote for us, if you can give us any feedback on the show in general, we'd really love that, either by literally putting in reviews into your podcast app of choice or giving us a 5-star rating. That would be really wonderful. But also, if you can just message us, do you like the format? Do you like these end of show episodes? Do you like the length of the shows? We try and keep them sub 45 minutes where we can. Do you want longer? Do you want shorter? What do you like? We really would love to know to make these shows the very best we possibly can for you. So that's just another call out. It's just more feedback, please. That'd be really, really appreciated.
Well, links to everything we've discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes.
We hope that this has been an interesting chat for you. See you next time. Keep secure, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?